This week on an all-new Dub, how to raise a right winger, muscle enhancement is the new anorexia, and the miracle of yawning fetuses. All this and a bunch more are right around the corner on a brand new Daddy on Board 112. Welcome to Daddy on Board, a parenting podcast from a dad's perspective. And that dad is me. My name is Mike Quackenbush, and I am both parent and podcaster. And I am also a professional wrestler. Don't tell my health insurance provider. Every week, me and my staff of highly trained capuchin monkeys comb through the interwebs in search of stories about the parenting experience, and then I make this podcast for you. I make it every week, except when there is a fifth week in the month, and I make it for free. I can only make this podcast for free thanks to the generous support of Cobra Electronics. They never give up. They're always there, fighting for freedom over land and air, and over the sea, too. In addition to GPS and radar detection devices, they specialize in marine navigation. Take a look at a gaggle of great gizmos and gadgets from our exclusive show sponsor over at Cobra.com. The New York Times asks, what should our kids read in school? Well, public school teachers have already begun implementing the Common Core State Standards. This is a set of national benchmarks that have been adopted by nearly every state for the skills public school students should master in both language arts and mathematics by grade 12. The standards won't actually take effect until 2014, but many public school systems have already begun adjusting their curriculums to satisfy these new mandates. For example, the Common Core dictates that by fourth grade, public school students devote half of their reading time in class to historical documents, scientific tracts, maps, and other informational texts like recipes and train schedules. Per these guidelines, 70% of the 12th grade curriculum will consist of non-fiction titles. Now, alarmed English teachers worry that we're about to toss Shakespeare out the window so students can study, in the words of one former educator, memos, technical manuals, and menus. An assumption that's being made on both sides of this argument here is that nonfiction literature isn't very literary. David Coleman, president of the College Board and one of the people who molded these guidelines, speaks in very utilitarian terms. Nonfiction is better training for real-world jobs. Now, I certainly see merit in that, given that I love to rail against those trends in education that seem to reflect no real-world applications or experiences. Like diagramming a sentence, Miss Brock. Do students need more exposure to nonfiction? Not so much to help with reading skills, but as a model for their own essays and expository writing that is critical in today's job market. Well, I tend to think that they do, but I don't see why these new guidelines are lopsided. Why not divide up fiction and nonfiction evenly on the reading list? While I appreciate the pragmatism behind the argument made by David Coleman and his supporters, developing a writing style requires a wide array of sources for inspiration. Developing a practical newspapery style of prose writing does have its value, but there's a reason why less and less people get their information from the newspaper every single day. By the time today's fourth graders are out in the real world, what passes for journalism today will most likely be extinct. Developing the great writers of tomorrow requires a solid background not just in informational texts, but exposure to the literary greats that worked in both fiction and nonfiction. Poetry and short stories and the great American novel are every bit as crucial as learning how to write a concise market analysis if the goal is to create well-rounded writers for tomorrow. And none of this involves diagramming a sentence, if I failed to mention that before. You know, every year at Black Friday, there's always these crazy news stories about people getting trampled in, like, human stampedes of folks trying to get to bargains through doorbuster sales and that kind of jazz. Well, here's a story that almost slipped through the cracks, but don't worry. I caught this Black Friday story for you. It's from Springfield, Massachusetts. Police say that a Massachusetts man left his girlfriend's 2-year-old son in a car while he went shopping on Black Friday for bargains. He then went home with his new 51-inch flat-screen television, but left the toddler behind. Police were alerted by store security, who found the boy asleep in the vehicle of a Kmart parking lot at 1:30 a.m. on Friday. They forced their way into the car, and they took the boy to the hospital as a precautionary measure. Meanwhile, they tracked the driver of the car to his Springfield home. He told police he lost the boy while shopping, panicked, and then he called someone else for a ride. The boy's mother was working at the time. The 34-year-old man was not arrested or immediately charged, but police say they expect to charge him with reckless endangerment of a child. At the very least, I would think. At the very least. Oh, man, I've got some earth-shattering news, first published by The Atlantic for you. Are you ready for this? Get ready. Here we go. Using 4D scanning technology, researchers at Durham and Lancaster universities announced that they were able to differentiate fetus mouth stretching from their yawns. That's right, with yawns, at least according to the new metrics that they've developed, it takes longer for a fetus to stretch its mouth to its fullest. Oh, man, this is a game changer. Now, the jury's still out on what business an unborn baby has yawning in the first place. They have nothing to report on that. Yawning doesn't become contagious until you're about age 5. And they're pretty isolated there in that amniotic bubble, so they're probably not trying to communicate by opening their mouths. It also seems unlikely to these university-level researchers that they're expressing sleepiness. All of this stuff has been backed up by tons of findings about the frequency of yawning. It appears to change throughout a fetus's maturation, and it peaks at 28 weeks. Yeah. Whew. All right, well, now you know, in case you're going on Jeopardy and any of that comes up. Tonight, I will venture out of my biodome to see the monkeys. Cast in a television show about a made-up rock band, Michael Nesmith, Mickey Dolenz, Peter Tork, and the late Davy Jones were meant to be a wooden entertainment puppet controlled by producers Bob Rafelson and Bert Schneider, as well as their music supervisor, Donnie Kirshner. But their Pinocchio came to life on them. The boys really became a band, and over a span of about 30 years, they released 11 studio albums, some of which are outstanding, and a few of which kind of stink, like Changes and Just Us. Newsman and fellow dad dude Clayton Morris and I are not going to see this concert to see what Papa Nez looks like at 70, or to see if Mickey still has any hair left, or if Peter Tork still resembles a hobo just like he has for most of the last 20 years. We will, along with a sold-out crowd, commune with a group and name that brought joy and optimism to our childhoods. Whether you discovered the Monkees in their original 60s run, or later in reruns in the 70s, or during the second wave of Monkey Mania that kicked off in 1986, you know that their charming, upbeat brand of pop music is the kind you cannot get out of your head, and their innocent and goofy TV show still makes for good, clean fun, even now, as it is closing in on its 50th year anniversary. The Monkees TV show is never obscene, contains virtually no violence, and isn't the slightest bit raunchy by 60s standards, let alone by today's television standards. It was ahead of its time when I first watched it as a 10-year-old boy, and it still is now to the eyes of my 3-year-old son, who watches the episodes with the same rapt attention I once did. I'm not advocating this form of entertainment in the hopes of acquiring Rhino Records as a sponsor of this show, or even just as an excuse to share my excitement over spending this evening with the 3 surviving members of the band. The Monkees taught me a few important life lessons. One I didn't really understand until years after the fact, when I discovered their struggle to free themselves of the control of Don Kirshner. The Monkees had hit songwriters penning number one chart toppers for their top-rated TV show, with musical tracks laid down by the best session players money could buy, and it was all neatly arranged for them. All they had to do was show up and wave when they were told to, and then sit back and let the money roll in. And the Monkees said, "No. We want to write the songs we sing. We want to play the instruments. We can do it ourselves." Even on the night their handlers cut them giant checks and awarded them gold records, even under the threat of being replaced on the TV show that made them household names and worldwide sensations, they would not take a back step. And you know what happened? Kirshner was fired. And beginning with their 3rd album, Headquarters, the Monkees wrote their own songs, played their own instruments in the studio, and picked the tracks that went on the albums. It would have been easy to just shut up, put their heads down, and let the machine keep on cranking, if not for a little thing called creative integrity. It didn't matter if the records lacked a certain polish or didn't produce the number one hits like the older ones did. The Monkees were going to do it on their own. And they did, and have, even now, 65 million records later. The other important thing I took away from the monkeys at a young age was something declared by my personal hero, Michael Nesmith, himself. In an episode where the devil grants Peter the ability to play the harp in exchange for his soul, Nez rushes to the defense when the devil comes calling to collect. Peter believes that he can only make great music because the devil enabled him. Nesmith argues against the devil thusly. Peter loved the music that came from the harp, and that was inside of him. The power of that love was inside of Peter. It was inside of him from the first. And it was that kind of power that made Peter able to play the harp. And you didn't have anything to do with it at all. When you have that inside of you, what comes out, if you love music, man, you can play music. People say, I can't carry a note. I can't sing. I'm tone deaf. But nobody's tone deaf. And if you love music, you can play music. That's where the power's at. You want to tell me that you gave it to him? Well, I know different. I might not have done a perfect job recreating Mike's soliloquy from the Devil and Peter Tork episode, but I got most of it. That's because I've heard those lines swirling around in my head for decades. It's about empowerment, about chasing that thing inside of you, even if everyone around you tells you for any number of practical or logical reasons that the goal you're striving to achieve is not within your power to obtain. I am tone deaf, and you know what? I played in a band that sounded like the one guy might be tone deaf. I've had every right-minded person in my life tell me that someone my shape, my size, with my background and vague skill set, could not and should not be a professional wrestler. But I am, and I have been for the last 18 years. I have never, for a moment, doubted that I could be exactly what I wanted to be. I knew it was the case, because the guy in the green wool hat told me so. I got a couple more stories around the corner for you, and I'm going to read your little victories before I'm through, too. But first, what will you find when you visit Cobra.com, other than a lot of anti-G.I. Joe rhetoric, that is? Well, I'll tell you. Our friends over at Cobra Electronics are makers of great solutions for those of us that live on the road, like yours truly, or if you live on the water, whatever the case might be. They've got over 40 years of experience producing dependable, top-quality tech. Radar detectors, GPS navigation, CB radios, marine electronics, so on and so forth. They're also makers of the ingenious Cobra Tag system, which pairs with your smartphone to make sure that whatever it is you want to protect with your Cobra Tag, like the keys you're always misplacing, the laptop bag you can't do without, that briefcase that has all that important top secret information about Duke and Flint in it, whatever the case might be, you can protect it and know you'll never misplace it when you've got the Cobra Tag system. When I go over to Cobra.com, the first place I always check is right on their left-hand navigation. You'll see a special section that's called Specials. Imagine that. And that's where you're going to get great deals like two-for-ones on some of their hottest-selling products and great deep discounts on a lot of others. And it refreshes all the time. So head over to Cobra.com and score a great deal for yourself right now. All right, Tennessee preacher Michael Pearl might be the source for the worst parenting advice in 2012, thanks to his controversial book, To Train Up a Child, which has been linked to the deaths of three children by abuse and neglect. Pearl advocates, among other things, hitting six-month-old babies with wooden spoons to chase out their selfish desires. Now, I like corporal punishment as much as the next guy, but even I'm wincing a little bit at that one. Inspired by this, our friends at the Huffington Post compiled a bunch of parenting advice from centuries past, and that list included these great gems. A U.S. Department of Labor pamphlet from 1929 counseled, "A baby should learn that crying will only cause his parents to ignore him." A number of turn-of-the-century books advised this, "Newborns should be, quote, well smeared in lard, olive oil, or fresh butter." For up to a week. I don't know. It sounds delicious. I don't know what it does. Miami pediatrician Walter Sackett Jr.'s 1962 book called Bringing Up Babies includes this harsh warning. Absolutely no night feedings, no matter how young the baby, nor how much it cries. If we teach our offspring to expect everything to be provided on demand, we must admit the possibility that we are sowing the seeds of socialism. Sackett likens overindulgent parents to Hitler and Stalin, which I think is fair and even-handed. A Dr. Sadler advised back in 1916 that breast milk from an angry mother was the cause of colic. Further brilliant shed on the topic comes in the 1877 book Advice to a Wife, which declares this scientifically irrefutable stance: breastfeeding after 9 months can cause blindness in mothers. Furthermore, it could cause your baby to develop brain disease. Which brain disease this might be, researchers did not say. The factually accurate 1916 book, The Mother and Her Child, advised against hiring single mothers to be wet nurses. Before hiring, this book advises parents to inspect the wet nurse's nipples and make sure she didn't menstruate during suckling. Also, be on the lookout for those that eat pastries or gravies. That's very important to the hiring process. The book suggests that prospective employers have the wet nurse milk her product into a glass so parents can ascertain if it is bluish-white in color and sweet to the taste. You know, it's easy for us now to look back on this type of folly and laugh, because people that came before us were stupid. But it also gives you a little bit of perspective on all those raising baby tomes that populate your bookcase, because you know, not long from now, smart people from the future are going to look back at the things written in those books and laugh at us, because we were stupid too. Let's see what else I got here. Researchers at the University of Illinois found that parenting style and childhood temperament play a key role in determining a child's future political mindset. So that bumper sticker your kid decides to slap on her car when she turns 18 may depend on how you reacted when she snuck out of the house to meet her boyfriend. This study finds that children of strict parents are more likely to turn conservative, while those of lenient parents were more likely to lean left. Apparently that's some kind of analogy for being liberal. What's more, children with higher levels of fearfulness during young childhood are more likely to have conservative values by the time they reach age 18. But on the other hand, kids with higher levels of attentional focusing and activity tend to end up liberally minded. Researchers collected this data from 708 children and their mothers, interviewing the mothers and asking them about their child-rearing philosophies when the child is just a month old. They then follow up 4.5 years later to study the children's temperaments, and then finally surveying the kids when they reach the age of 18. Quote, "One of the significant challenges in psychological science is understanding the multiple pathways underlying personality development," lead researcher R. Chris Fraley said. He goes on to say this, quote, "Our research suggests that variation in how people feel about diverse topics ranging from abortion, military spending, and the death penalty can be traced to both temperamental differences that are observable as early as 54 months of age, as well as variation in the attitudes people's parents have about child rearing and discipline," end quote. The study didn't look at other factors that might play into the development of a person's political beliefs, such as culture, friends, and environment. Why not? Probably because tracking and interpreting the data these additional factors represent would be messy and time-consuming. They had to be done in time for their big interview with Live Science, okay? So use that data to help you develop your own little right or left winger. I originally came in to today's podcast thinking those were positions played in lacrosse. Apparently they aren't. All right, here's a headline for you. Drinking even a few alcoholic beverages per week during pregnancy could lower a baby's IQ by a few points, a new study published November 14th in the journal PLOS ONE says. This only furthers my argument that all these journals need to be consolidated into one journal that's just called Journal. The findings also suggest that women whose babies process alcohol slowly are at greater risk of harming their baby's brain development. Ron Gray of the University of Oxford and his colleagues tried to isolate the effects of drinking from other lifestyle factors by looking at genes that control alcohol breakdown in the body. Those who clear alcohol from the bloodstream more slowly expose their fetuses to more alcohol, even if they drink the same amount. As a result, drinking would have a greater impact on their baby's brain development regardless of their social or lifestyle factors, the researchers have decided. Women who clear alcohol quickly may be more insulated from these effects. From Ron Gray, he says, quote, some women are going to be genetically more vulnerable or resilient than others to the effects of alcohol on the fetus, but there is no way of knowing who those people are. I've also got, I've got another story here for you. Okay, and this one. Hannah Rose of Slate.com blogged this week about body-obsessed boys and muscle enhancement. Now, her blog stems from a New York Times piece about middle school boys that count calories, drink weird powdery shakes instead of just eating regular meals, and they take pills that alarm even their pediatricians. This type of changing self-image relating to boys' bodies have some comparing it to the anorexia epidemic facing girls. According to a new study published in Pediatrics, boys surveyed in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area reported a record number of muscle-enhancing behaviors, which included everything from going to the gym to taking steroids. Two-thirds of the mostly middle school-age boys were taking actions to increase their muscle size. For example, 34.7% were drinking protein shakes, and 6% were taking steroids. Researchers attribute this trend to a stark increase in scantily dressed men in advertising and a bulking up of action figures, triggering increased body dissatisfaction and muscle dysmorphia in young men. Some of this, I'll admit, is alarming, but not all of it. But what does this all really mean? Well, it means boys have just as many warped misconceptions about their bodies as girls do. The researchers attempt to pin blame for this in strange places, including social media, for example. I happen to think that it's the world at large, not any one thing or outlet, that makes people think twice about their own bodies. I'm really used to my own body, for example. It's the same one that I've always had, just wrinklier than before. There are those companies that push certain types of commercial rhetoric about fitness, or muscle enhancement, or nutrition, or whatever, because they have a product they need you to buy. And I'm not saying let's organize a mob and run GNC out of the mall with our pitchforks and torches, but we Americans really vote with our dollars, right? We have to. Our votes in elections don't actually matter so long as we have an electoral college. It's like a placebo the royals toss from their gold-encrusted carriages to the filthy peasants to keep them pacified while they go about mucking everything up. I don't know how I got off on that tangent. Anyway, as parents, we must be careful what we expose our kids to and how that media or rhetoric influences their behaviors and thought processes. How can we keep our sons from becoming obsessed with building muscle? I don't know. I think the gym is boring and it smells weird, and I don't like the old guy that walks around naked after he comes in from the pool. Talking to our kids about steroids or any drug is important, though. If my son wants a tub of protein powder so badly he saves up his weekly 25-cent allowance to buy that tub, well, power to him. It'll also take him like 7 years. If he'd rather lift weights than play video games or watch an episode of Scooby-Doo, I don't know that really is an epidemic. I'm not really sure that these people have framed their findings correctly, but I want to know what you think. So I'd like for you to drop by our Facebook fan page or our Google Plus page, or you could tweet it to me on Twitter. And if I get some responses from you, I'll probably read them here next week on the show. I will. You loyal dub bobbers out there know I like to conclude every program by reading your little victories sent in to me on our Facebook fan page. They're tweeted to me at The Daddy on Board or posted up on Google Plus where we occasionally look. Before I read your little victories this week, I want to remind you that this weekend I will be wrestling live on pay-per-view as part of Chikara's 11th season finale, taking place live on Sunday afternoon, December 2nd, from the Trocadero Theater in Philadelphia at 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. You can stream it live at smvod.com, as I'm pretty sure there are virtually no tickets left available to come and see it live at the theater. So stream it from the comfort of your own home. SMVOD.com has that information for you. And next weekend, December 8th, I'll be wrestling in Enosburg Falls, Vermont. On December 9th, I'll be in Troy, New York for Wrestling is Awesome. So come and check it out. Come and see me live. I love to meet loyal dub bobbers like you live and in person. And now, without further ado, I will read your little victories. This first one was sent in to me by Mario Leon. Mario writes, My little kindergartner read her first book on her own. And that is very impressive, especially if it's not one of those picture books, like if there are words and stuff. Very impressive, Mario. Thank you for sending that in. Fellow dad blogger and a friend of the program, Raul Colon, you know him from papaheroes.com, wrote this to me. Our daughter knows that she needs to neutralize mosquitoes. And I'm not really sure that I fully appreciate what that is that you're trying to tell me with that one, Raul. But I guess that's cool. And mosquitoes do need to be neutralized. Maybe you could bring your daughter over the next time I'm having a picnic to neutralize mosquitoes. We should get together, Raul. We should have a joint picnic. That'd be great. I don't know where you live, Raul. Also, Sam Korn, loyal dub bobber, frequent contributor to the Little Victories, wrote this. Catherine danced in the Chicago Thanksgiving Day parade. Now, I don't really know who Catherine is, Sam. If this is your sister-in-law, for example, or your mom, I don't know that that's all that impressive. But I suspect it might be your little one. And if so, congratulations. That's a big deal, being in the Thanksgiving Day parade. I would love to be in the Thanksgiving Day parade. I'd like to be one of the guys that holds the Spider-Man balloon. And I've wanted that job since I was a kid. Basically, since the year they introduced the Spider-Man balloon, I've wanted to be the guy that holds the Spider-Man balloon. Thank you for sending in your little victories to me. Next week, I will return to the program. I will collate a batch of parenting stories from the news world, the blogosphere, and beyond. I will bring them to you with my own inimitable perspective. Between then and now, I will make the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe podcast with my pal Clayton Morris. On the upcoming episode, we are joined by Glenn Phillips, frontman of the recently reunited Toad the Wet Sprocket. You remember them, right? Walk on the Ocean, All I Want, all that. You know those guys. I'll probably also make a trending show with Natalie Morris, where I'll tell you all about the top trending topics in Google and on Twitter. And then I will return in about a week's time with a podcast I am most certainly going to entitle Daddy on Board 113. Until then, adios, amigos.